In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Okay, there'll be spoilers. That's it. That's the truncated, introduction. And welcome to the March Came In Like a Panther, March Goes Out Like a Sparrow, a Kaiju, Lara, a Gnome, or a Dog episode of Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy with my friends and guests, my co-hosts, whatever you want to call yourself, introduce yourself as always.
Nico.
And Jen.
Yay! And now... we get to talk about what do you want? Do you want to start? I guess we'll start with Red Sparrow.
Yeah,
that was the last one we saw. Mm. I mean, the one we saw first.
Nico and Rick saw Red Sparrow. Oh, yeah. I did not see Red Sparrow.
And why didn't you see Red Sparrow?
I was told that Red Sparrow would upset me, so I just avoided it altogether.
Why do you think? What did they say would upset you about it?
There was just something. Somebody said something happens in it, so I'm guessing it's just some kind of like super ultra violent thing that happens to somebody, and it would just upset me. And I don't need that in my life.
I personally don't think that, and you know, I completely empathize with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain movies I hate,
mm-hmm.
and I just get very upset that I saw them,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I always try to find out what the ending of movies are.
And that's why I never see Alien Covenant.
Exactly, because it's a hateful movie, which I hated, and you probably know that if you've listened to these at all. My theory as to why you wouldn't have enjoyed Red Sparrow is the whole effing concept of it. And it's interesting because all of the live-action movies we'll be discussing here, if we even discuss the animated ones, I don't know because there's not a lot of action in them, although in a way there is, and we should discuss it because you guys work for an animation company, so this mm-hmm. is a perfect opportunity to discuss them. All of the live-action ones, or at least the two major female-driven live-action ones, Red Sparrow and Tomb Raider, I am deeply, deeply concerned about, because I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast. I've mentioned this in my writing. When Thelma and Louise came out, Hollywood banded together after its success to make sure that they could say that that was the exception and not the rule, and that women couldn't carry an action film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they... I've gotten this firsthand, as well as secondhand, thirdhand, and other things, that Hollywood, the producers, just because this is the way they play, as Sue Grafton put it, the late Sue Grafton, the great best-selling author, put it, an ex-screenwriting ex-screenwriter, Sue Grafton, the reason she left Hollywood, left script writing and went into book writing, and she did the famous private detective series, A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, etc. And I believe this sounds familiar, but I can't be sure whether I put it on the podcast before. The reason she left Hollywood is because she didn't like the way the producers played.
Mm-hmm.
And the producers, the above-the-line ones, the venal backstabbing ones, the ones who are insecure, the ones who want to put creative people who they resent under their thumb, the way they play is sometimes taking people, giving them their dreams, and then dashing them on purpose, having fun. This is the way they have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after Thelma and Louise, I have been assured by more than one person, many people, in fact, is that this happened, that they wanted to make sure that they could say when any female star came up and said, well, what about Thelma and Louise? That was a success.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They could say, oh, no, that was the exception. And they said that, again, I put this on record elsewhere, they said that to Jackie Chan's face the day after he premiered Police Story at the New York Film Festival. I was standing there. That wasn't even firsthand. That,
mm-hmm.
that was firsthand. I was there.
Yeah.
When a Hollywood producer said to Jackie Chan and his producer, we were in an elevator at the Helmsley Plaza or whatever on Fifth Avenue, and he was saying this is what he wanted to do next after the huge success of Police Story
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
at the New York Film Festival. And the executive went, oh, no. America will never accept a Chinese hero.
That's cool.
And his producer, no relation, David Chan, said, what about Bruce Lee?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the executive said, with a shit-eating grin, oh, Bruce Lee was the exception. Then after that, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon comes out, no Americans, in Chinese, subtitles, two major female leads, more than $100 million at the box office, and Oscars, and everybody and the Weinsteins and others gathered together to make sure that became the exception. So after Wonder Woman, we see Red Sparrow, and then I see Tomb Raider. And the thing that both Red Sparrow and Tomb Raider have in common is that the movie goes way out of its way to turn the leading character. You remember what Wonder Woman is like, right? Wonder Woman is exhilarating. Wonder Woman is just like awesome. You look at her and you go, wow. And you look at Red Sparrow, and especially Lara Croft, and you go, this is an idiot. This is a depressed, doer, unexhilarating idiot.
That makes me sad. No, Miko saw Red Sparrow. Miko and I have not seen Tomb Raider yet.
You will be I think.
Really? The trailers looked so good for Tomb Raider. I really thought that would be the exception to the video game movie rule.
No.
I guess we'll hold out for Rampage.
And also, it's Rampage, the new preview looked awesome. But be that as it may, I will tell you exactly what happened with Tomb Raider, which was astonishing to me and really worried me. Because Red Sparrow worried me a little bit. Red Sparrow was what I call the Alien 3 of this new thing. Because Alien 3 was the crown and the jewel.
I wouldn't go that far.
But listen to this. Okay. No, but listen. You'll see the comparison. What they needed after Thelma and Louise, they needed at least three movies to destroy the idea that women could carry an action film.
It's like, I was gonna be like the Halle Berry Catwoman movie. Derailing female superhero movie.
And the attempts of the Broccoli family and Eon, the creators of the James Bond series, to create a parallel action series with Michelle Yeoh and then Halle Berry from the James Bond movies, both of which got so close, and then studios shot them down. So here's what happened. After Thelma and Louise, they had a movie called A Stranger Among Us, and then they had, a V.I. Warshawski, both of which were just like DOA, but they had to get a major movie with a major star to prove, in quotes, that women couldn't carry it. That movie was Alien 3. And I will not tell you who told me this. Two people, very, very powerful people in Hollywood who were intimately involved with Alien 3, told me that after Alien 2, Aliens, they went to the studio, because Aliens is one of the rare sequels that made more money than the original. So they walked into 20th Century Fox saying, open up the vaults. We know there's only two things that the third Alien movie can be about. Ripley going to the alien planet, the aliens coming to Earth. And 20th Century Fox said, nope, it's going to be about a prison planet. We're cutting your budget like by two-thirds. And apparently the scream of the producers could be heard throughout Hollywood. And for years, they couldn't understand why until they floated the theory that they told me. So now Red Sparrow comes out. It has a major star. Jennifer Lawrence. It's directed by the guy who did Hunger Games, Francis Lawrence. He did a lot of videos, and then he did the last three Hunger Games movies. So they have a very good relationship.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. And it was
okay, I'm sorry. I like Hunger Games.
No.
So did I. And I like Maze Runner, which we'll get to, because that's another writer.
Really?
Well, I'm the one who saw it. You guys didn't
see
it. That's true,
because it's just...
But it is... The Maze Runner Death Cure is very similar to Pacific Rim... Uprising.
All right, fine.
Because, well, we'll get to it. But right now we're dealing with Red Sparrow and Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
It's written, Red Sparrow was written by Justin Haythe, H-A-Y-T-H-E, Haythe, who wrote Revolutionary Road, but also wrote The Lone Ranger. The Johnny Depp Lone Ranger.
Whoa.
Yeah. But in any case, the fight coordinator was Can Aiden, who was mostly a stunt double. He was in Wolf Warrior 2. And he did Hitman Agent 47. He's a German guy. He did Mockingjay when it filmed in Berlin. So he's connected to the Hunger Games stuff too. But Red Sparrow was just a total, the character was was dull on arrival, not even dead on arrival. DOA, dull on arrival.
It is a pretty dull
movie. Super serious, super somber.
Very slow. It's a drama than anything else.
I mean, and of course, nothing, we have a favorite fight moment, but I think what would have upset and upset me was that the character was forced into it, never wanted to do anything, and it basically starts with a double rape, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she doesn't really react to that. It's kind of like Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies, who makes fun of Michelle Yeoh's kung fu.
Yeah.
And they don't allow Michelle Yeoh to show him the error of his opinion.
Mm.
And the whole movie's just this downer. And the height of the action comes...
The only action.
Yeah, the only action, really. Comes when the lover, the American agent... And the Russian agent, do they love each other? Do they really love each other? Who are they truly loyal to? Doesn't make any difference. But he gets attacked by the big-time Russian male assassin who has an anger against the female, insidious undercover Red Sparrow person. And he has the American spy pulled to the chair, and is choking him and is planning to strip his skin
using
torture.
Using a skin grafting machine that people use for burn victims.
Yeah, and
see, he's going to slowly do it.
And you see the evidence of his torture earlier in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these patches of skin missing off of the corpses. But it's not until then that he explains what it is.
Right.
Graphic stuff. So here's Jennifer Lawrence. You've seen some of her training. You know she is a trained Russian spy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she, pretends that, I'm completely on your side, bad Russian agent. I'm going to help you kill my lover here. And she says, let me do it. And she takes the skin grafting thing and she starts grafting them. And then, of course, hits the Russian agent with the skin grafting thing,
mm-hmm.
knocking him to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jen, if that were you, what would you do next?
Do I have a gun?
No, but you have that skin grafting thing. You hit him with it. And by the way, the table right next to her lover
Has
is filled with knives.
Torture devices.
Well, I was just going to say, I would kill him and make sure he was dead.
Exactly.
Because I'm assuming what happened is, they knock him out and they leave the bad guy on the
Does
side.
Does it even knock him out?
They go do something else and then he shows
she
up.
She jumps.
She jumps to try to rescue.
Not even rescue.
Yeah, untie.
Untie him.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
her agent, her
English, rescue.
And it's like, and both
yeah.
Miko and I are going, what?
Yeah, it was a fucking dumb moment. It honestly is.
It's
like, legit is.
Astonishingly dumb.
For not even a spy, like a trained spy, just for a normal
just someone
human.
Someone trying to get away from somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Somebody
make
with
sure,
a brain.
Yeah, you want to make sure that person's dead.
Someone, I always love.
But it gets worse from there.
It does. Go ahead, Miko.
Okay, it gets worse from there because as soon as the Russian spy comes up with a knife, right? He grabs onto a knife. What do you do with a knife?
You stab or slice.
You stab somebody.
You stab somebody to death, right?
Yeah. He sliced people.
He slices them.
He keeps slicing them. He just think that doesn't make sense for anybody. Why would you slice people that you're ready to kill?
Right. And the whole movie was like this. The whole movie was dull on arrival, dead on arrival. It was so self-important. It was so ridiculously somber.
So
it was the anti-Wonder Woman.
Right. I personally enjoyed the drama part of it.
Fine.
The action was bad.
Yeah.
The drama was okay. And I do agree with you with some the acting choices where, like when she got raped, she was just a female who hadn't experienced that before, and her reaction wasn't...
It's not an exhilarating or acceptable film. Now, hilariously, Tomb Raider, by the time we get to the exact same scene.
Wait, which would you mean by the exact same scene?
Later on in the film, Lara Croft finds her father, who she thought has been dead for 7 years.
Right.
And he is, wait a minute, is that, no, I'm sorry, this was just before she finds her father.
Okay.
She's being tracked after she escaped from the villains on the island, and the guy has got her, and he is beating the crap out of her, and suddenly she magically learns shit that she should not know, but she manages to actually kill this guy. She does kill this guy ridiculously in a puddle. She drowns him in a puddle in ways that it's like, that's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
But that's fine. He has a crap load of weapons on him. She runs away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's dead. And leaves his gun. Leaves his knife.
Oh, yeah.
Leaves his machete.
Of course.
Leaves everything.
I hate when movies do that.
Because all you need is bow and arrow and a ice pick.
But we're not even done with that
That's
yet.
That's like not even good game logic.
That's not even done with that yet. Tomb Raider was directed by Roar Utog, a Norwegian, who's only done 10 other films with multi-year gaps between the films.
Well, I mean, 10 films. You say that like only 10 movies.
No. That's
pretty impressive.
That is very impressive. And there were Norwegian films, and I imagine they had a big gap between each of them because it's not easy to find money in Norway.
Right.
So he directed it. Geneva Robertson Dvoret has one credit, but she's now credited with the new Captain Marvel script, as well as Sherlock Holmes 3 and the new Dungeons & Dragons movie.
Wait, Sherlock Holmes 3?
Is it a D&D movie?
Oh.
Yeah, another D&D movie.
Wait, what?
Yeah, coming up.
Okay.
Coming up. And Alistair Siddons, who only has one previous credit, Trespass Against Us, were credited as the Tomb Raider writers. On the basis of Tomb Raider, the movie that I saw, I believe that they were just hired, these two women, one woman, Geneva Robertson. Alistair was different. Roar was given a shot, but I think they were hired, my guess, is because they were controllable. They were handleable. Because if you want to see a textbook example of how to diminish a hero, male or female, in an audience's eyes, watch the first half hour of Tomb Raider. It's fascinating. It's almost clinical in its subterfuge.
Wait, so are you talking more about, like, put your character in a tree and throw rocks at them? Or are you saying it goes beyond that in terms of, like, how crappy...
It's puppet mastery.
But in terms of, like, the story structure? Or, like, I don't understand.
The movie opens. What I'm saying is they're taking a character who everybody knows is one of the great female heroes in entertainment, and they're pretending, yeah, we love her. We love her. Look how great she is. They have a wonderful actress.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's just...
Oh, yeah, Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, she almost saves it, but she can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they do is almost genius in its subtle subterfuge and sabotage, in that they present her as a hero, but they also present her as a total tool, as an annoying... What's some of the words for her?
Don't say precocious.
Petulant, self-destructive, idiot. She's an idiot.
She's an a-hole.
The movie starts...
I think she sounds like a bro.
Well, that's it. The movie starts with a fight scene. They're showing her in the ring, and other than showing Alicia's awesome abs, she has... Awesome abs.
Yeah.
She's fighting another woman in a ring in a gym in England, and she's totally losing. She's getting the crap beat out of her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, my head is shaking. I'm saying, okay, great. She's fighting this other female fighter who I say, oh, she's going to learn from her. She's going to learn from her. She's going to get better. And in fact, the female fighter comes in afterwards into the locker room to say and literally says to Lara Croft, "We okay?"
Oh, that's good.
But that is great. But what isn't great is how Lara Croft reacts.
Oh.
She doesn't react by saying, "Yeah, show me how you do that. I want to learn. Show me how to do that better." She goes, she sort of dismisses her. And then after the woman leaves, very nice woman, big smile, very friendly, Lara Croft, kind of dismisses her, makes fun of her.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
There are 3 to 4 scenes in a row almost exactly like that, all designed specifically to show you what an a-hole she is.
That's interesting.
What a petulant, depressive, negative a-hole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like... And so when we get to the video game stuff, I wanted to like her. I wanted to feel... I talked to several people in the audience because we're in a regular theater and we're talking. We're in the theater talking to each other, throwing our hands up in the air, shaking our heads. I mean, there was two bros over here. Yeah. There were two bros next to me.
Uh-huh.
But they loved video games and Lara Croft, and they're going,
right.
Because there are so many moments in the movie where, you know, whoever thought that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing that the movie does, which is very annoying and ridiculous and amazing, in that it creates scenes that seemingly are purposely designed to demoralize you, in that they make choices
mm-hmm.
to concentrate on things that the audience is already way ahead of you on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when they're instead of taking a character who we know could get killed because they're not a major character, they're not the head of a franchise,
right,
and threatening them in a way so there's suspense created, they take all that time, which is somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes, and concentrate on scenes where they're threatening Lara.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know she's not going to die.
Yeah, I think that's.
I hate that.
Yeah, I think that's a very annoying.
Yeah, point. They do it multiple times in the movie.
Point.
Not only do they undercut her character at every turn.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, her father is telling her how smart and wonderful she is, while the audience is just, now you can't do that, Jen. We're recording a podcast, Jen. By the way, everybody, we just saw Isle of Dogs, which we'll get to, which was just super awesome. And we're talking about that. And instead of dealing with Tomb Raider, you just showed us the most adorable picture of a puppy ever.
My family got a new puppy.
I saw that in your Facebook.
I keep getting pictures, and it's very exciting.
It's very exciting, but don't interrupt. Come on. I'm ripping Tomb Raider a new one. Stop interrupting the ripping, because this is important for you.
Okay.
This is important. I believe this is Hollywood again. Because see what's happening to Wonder Woman. See what's happening to the Wonder Woman sequel. These are the guys who've destroyed Green Lantern and Superman and Batman and Justice League and Suicide Squad. And now they've got to take down Wonder Woman.
Oh, my God.
And what's the first thing they've done? You know who the villainess is in the next Wonder Woman. You know who's playing her.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember, but I remember it.
Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, that.
Cheetah. Do you think that's going to turn out okay?
That sounds dumb as fuck.
Wait, Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. Yes. Playing Cheetah, of all the possible, if that's the right name, and I know all you comic book guys will correct me, but it's something like that. But it's a cartoonish villain.
You know what? I think the moral of the story is everybody needs to pull a Fury Road and bait and switch.
Well, that's what I'm sure.
That's what I feel like, because I remember that pissed off so many dudes, and I was just like, "Fuck yeah!"
No,
but Marvel still exists, and Disney still exists, and they're doing Captain Marvel, and they're doing other female.
Yeah, what is that movie man. number 23? It finally took them.
But they're doing it, and they're not going. And they're not
23.
Going. They're not going to Red Sparrow, and they're not going to Tomb Raider it.
We have yet to see that.
I mean,
it's unlikely.
Marvel movies are usually pretty cheerful.
I mean, they're usually
not just cheerful; they're positive, and their heroes are heroes and not undercut.
I don't know about. I can see that with Lara Croft, but I can't. I don't know if that sentiment is correct for Red Sparrow, because Jennifer Lawrence has made some choices recently of films that has not been critically.
They haven't been good movies.
And then they haven't been making a lot of money.
And people have been taking advantage of her interesting
stardom.
Personality.
Yeah, that's true.
And she's willing to be used.
Yeah, at the
moment. And how did you know how Red Sparrow did?
I have no idea.
Well,
it shouldn't do so well.
Yeah,
I don't think it did.
Be that as it may. And Tomb Raider, I don't think will either. Meanwhile...
Right.
The stunt coordinator was Mark Hansen, who had 91 credits, mostly Vikings television show. The fight coordinator was Grant Powell. He's a newbie, mostly done TV like Strike Back and Black Sails. Again, these are guys who could be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
The UK fight coordinator is Roy Taylor, who's mostly a stuntman, although he's supposedly doing fight coordinating on Solo, the new Star Wars movie. And the parkour choreographer was DeVille Vanek, who did the stunts in Maze Runner and also on Doctor Who at one point. And I'm going... Parkour? There was parkour in Tomb Raider? And I had to think about it and went, oh yeah, there was parkour that was so uninspiring. They were running around the wharves of Hong Kong, all the boat people of Hong Kong.
Oh.
And everything was so super lame in that movie from a fight standpoint. You've played the video game, right?
I didn't finish it, but I played most of it.
You played most of it.
I was going to say,
yeah.
The airplane, the falling into water.
Yeah, all that's
all
valid.
Of that, that's the first 30 minutes
yes.
of the game.
But I understand that.
So I don't know how much.
And that was pretty cool. But my question is, and this was my big question, because as I was watching, I was going, oh, I see what they're doing. They were doing it all in the name. I know this. I don't know this. I'm certain of this. They're doing it in the name of identifying with her. So she's relatable. That's why they're going to, that's why they went, I'm sure, mm-hmm. they went to her, Alicia, and everybody else, and going, oh, we can't have her be like the video game character. So my question to you is she an a-hole in the game?
No, she's not.
I'll say
no.
That's what kind of annoys me, because for me it's like, I don't have a problem with, like, a female character being unlikable. Like, we've
yeah.
had so many films with unlikable
protagonists. Yeah.
But they should know what they're doing.
Well, yes. Not even that. Yeah, but for me, again, yeah, for me it was kind of like, I've never played any of the games, but I was kind of like, I know enough about it to know that that's not the character even.
Yeah.
That's
so, like,
the point.
That annoys me.
Well, every
that's
time,
the point.
Well,
yeah,
I was going to say, every time there's a director or whatever, whoever going to direct a video game that has a very full cinematic mm-hmm. storyline throughout the whole game, and they don't hire anyone who's part of the creation of that game.
Right. Mm-hmm. Bad sign.
That's just like, they're not going to
well,
make a
like,
good movie.
For me, it's kind of like, I get that any video game movie is going to be challenging because you're dealing with like 72 hours of content
of
and character development and story being like thrown into, you know, a 2-hour movie. So for me, like, the vibe that I get hearing, again, not having seen it, but like hearing the conversation is, okay, like, we need to basically create a personality for this character, because in the game, you know, characters are usually left pretty, they were pretty blank slate so that you
yep.
can, you know, project onto them.
Yep.
So for me, it sounds almost like they probably tried multiple versions of this character, and then this was the one where they were like, well, you know, at least she's got some bite and
you
some
know
attitude.
You know what, I disagree.
That's fine.
With
I'll
so,
allow it.
So with a lot of, with a lot of Jeff. The past games, yes, a lot of the characters are left kind of mushy, so you can play the game and then project yourself, but a lot of games right now, since the, you know, the rise of the graphic,
yeah,
everything, all the story has a very strong cinematic, very strong personality,
good
that you
characterization
love, that
yeah.
you root for,
yep.
and that you play with,
I
and
know.
You feel bad
but
at
I'm
empowered
saying maybe
by
they
the action.
Tried that, they probably had
they
a
did
draft.
Not try that. They did not try that.
I think they probably had a draft, and they were like, they got some exec note, and they were like, she's boring.
No, well, that may have been, but the point is,
maybe.
The result is that she is the anti Lara. The action segments are quite good. The video game segments, right from the video game. The huge difference, however, is that that's not Lara Croft.
Yeah, yeah.
That
no.
is the anti Lara. She is designed to be annoying, not sympathetic, not interesting. In fact, so blindingly stupid
mm-hmm.
that it's impossible to side with her.
Yeah.
You want her to get hurt. You want her to disappear because she's given. But like they did with Ripley in Alien 3, they have to give the actress an excuse. And the excuse, I'm certain, is, oh, we want to make her relatable. And that is that's the word they use to make her into a vulnerable jerk.
Mm.
Now, vulnerable, I don't mind. Jerk, I mind.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it's Lara Croft
mm-hmm.
or Laura Croft, however you do it. I believe, when I was watching it, I was going, is this purposeful? And now that I think back on it, I am certain it's purposeful. That
yeah.
they wanted to undercut this
yeah.
the way,
I mean,
any way they could.
I was going to say, with amount of people who likes the video game, who loves Lara Croft, and her, like, her stardom...
Yeah.
I'm not sure why the movie didn't do well, other than the fact that the story sucked.
Because it's, well, not just that the story didn't actually suck. The character sucked. It's called Tomb Raider. And the Tomb Raider is someone who is just unlikable
mm-hmm.
because she's so stupid. And I was trying to think of the right word for her, dullard. She was somebody who's negative throughout, who's depressed throughout. Every decision she makes in the first half of the movie is a stupid one. It's an indefensible one. And you're going, and again, at the end of the movie, the father's telling her how smart and wonderful she is, and we in the audience is going, I don't know where you're coming up with that, because everything she done is the opposite of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, and being a writer, being someone who, when I have a character act a certain way, I'm trying to elicit a reaction from the audience. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, well, why would anybody do this? And I went, oh, well, that's at least a reason. And also, I've seen it happen before. I mean, I saw it happen with Chinese stars. I saw it happen with women. I saw it happen with African Americans. And I'm going to be curious. I don't think they can do it to Black Panther. Mm-hmm. I don't think they can do it to African Americans at this point. I think they've gotten too powerful. But I think they're trying to do it again to women. We'll see what happens with Captain Marvel and others. But anyway, so that's that. Let's go on to a more pleasant subject on a movie we've all seen. Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yeah.
Put your hands on.
Also, not that good.
Shut the fuck
Miko
up.
Miko didn't like it. Wait a minute. No, Miko has.
I enjoyed
you
it.
You cannot say it's not that good. You could say I didn't like it that much.
No, I didn't like it, and it's also not that good.
How story compared wise. To what?
Compared to the first one. You always compare the sequel to the first one.
I do.
That's the basis.
No one's saying nobody's not doing that.
Yeah. Well, so it's not good compared
to
the first one.
Well, here, myself and another friend of mine like the second one better for very specific reasons.
Okay.
And again, we're back to this sort of Last Jedi situation where I agree with both of you. I called it silly. I called it contrived.
Yep.
And cliched.
Yep.
And then I said I liked it.
Hell yeah.
There you go. So because
I knew exactly what I was signing up for signed up for Rock'em Sock'em Robots too.
I did too.
But I didn't know.
But the fact that they treat it so seriously throughout the whole film.
Are you kidding? Did you hear the dialogue? They weren't treating that seriously.
The dialogue was cheesy, but they were
treating it. But the actors were great.
I know.
The actors were great. How do you pronounce it? John Boyega?
John Boyega.
Boyega, who's the star of that movie. He didn't get. Nobody lied to him and said they wanted to make him relatable.
You know, I feel like it would help have you ever seen him in Attack the Block?
Yeah, I saw him in Attack the Block.
I feel like if you've seen him in that and then you see him in this, you're just like, okay.
No,
the thing is,
like, for me, for this film, in terms of like how the characters are, I like some of the characters, not all of the characters. I do like John Boyega's character.
I thought he was great.
And I like.
I liked Amara.
The baby soldier. I thought
the
was
little girl.
The baby soldier.
Amara.
Yeah, I don't really care for her because her character is so underdeveloped. And every time you show her, something else new happened to her that like happened off the screen that you just have to accept.
Yeah, but here's the deal. We didn't see a Pacific Rim 1 together,
right?
But we did see Power Rangers together,
yeah.
And we didn't see Transformers 5 together, right?
No,
hell no.
I haven't seen them.
I've seen all three of them.
I refuse.
I've seen all three of them, and I wasn't happy with any of them.
Yeah.
And as soon as I started realizing what I thought was happening with Pacific Rim Uprising, I went, all right.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure Stephen S. DeKnight, the TV writer-director who did Buffy, Angel, Smallville, Spartacus, and the Netflix Daredevil, he was the co-writer and director of Pacific Rim Uprising. The other writer was Emily Carmichael, who only has written shorts before this, Kira Snyder, who's the producer and writer of Handmaid's Tale, and T.S. Nolan, who worked on the Maze Runner movies, specifically Death Cure. Mm-hmm. They were the other writers. And what I feel was happening was they also saw those other movies and didn't like them. Mm-hmm. So what they went, tell you what we're going to do. We can't make something new. Let's just take our favorite pieces.
Honestly, this was,
of these other movies.
This is YA Pacific Rim, and like I was down for it.
And what happened was it was better than Power Rangers.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That girl came from Transformers.
Oh, she was a girl.
Not the same actress, but the same character.
Yeah, I was going to say.
There's a character just like that.
There's like a
like that.
Little girl in the new Transformers film.
Almost exactly the same girl.
Yeah.
At one point, I really wanted. I mean, I think in the extras, I hope in the extras of the DVD, which I'm probably not going to get, when she appears to John Boyega, I hope you can see off in the distance what's his name from Transformers 5 going, oh, and then backing away. Mm-hmm. Because it's like she ran from Transformers 5 into Pacific Rim.
I was thinking about that too, because I was thinking about how a lot of these movies now are trying to add in, you know, diversity and whatever, and I was thinking about how I'm like, wow, this has become like a trope of like the precocious, like super smart mechanics girl in like the post-apocalyptic monster wasteland.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'll allow it.
Yeah, let's do it. And also, I'm writing another Ghost.
No, no problem with her character specifically, but her character is so underutilized. Not underutilized, but underdeveloped.
Yeah, but if you saw Transformers 5, you'd go, okay.
Yeah.
But what's happening now is I'm doing another ghost-written novel, and I can't write worse than the original writer of the ghost-written novel that I'm doing. Mm. And I completely empathize with the makers of Pacific Rim, because they sort of went, we can't do worse than Power Rangers. We can't do worse than Transformers 5.
See, the thing is, but I'm not putting them on that platform.
I am.
On Pacific Rim, which is fantastic, because, again,
I didn't think it was fantastic.
They were using a fucking boat to use as a baseball bat to bat. Like, that was fun.
That was one of the few moments of that original
Again,
movie that I liked.
Yeah, this one doesn't have a moment that I like. Again, when like, even with the action was kind of dull for me because it was all over the place when all of the sock and roll. When all the Jaegers are in the city, when all the Jaegers in the city, they're going towards the three kaijus, the action was all over the place. You don't know who's where, like, location-wise. You have no idea where
I was
where.
Told that. You told me that, in fact. But I didn't have a problem.
Yeah, I didn't.
Interestingly enough, I didn't have a problem.
I mean, for me, it was kind of like, I got in the first film, it was all still new. They had to explain everything. They had to be like, the neural connection, the drift. You were like, okay. And then for this one, it was like, all right, just let's go.
That's fine.
At first, I didn't like the new plot. I was going, oh, they really reduced it. And then I went, no, that's smart. And then I saw what they were doing again, using little bits and pieces of all these other movies.
I will say the one thing I had, like, a proper problem with was Mako dying. That was completely, like, she got fridged for John Boyega's character, and I, like, do not approve.
Yeah,
I understand that.
100%.
But I'm saying, like, I'm very, again, like, I acknowledge that this movie was, like, just a weird popcorn movie.
Yeah.
But, like,
but
so
fun.
Like, I'm forgiving, but that was the one thing story-wise where I was just like, fuck you.
Also, it's very hard for me to believe that in the Shell industry, have that building there, they're announcing the drone program, they couldn't detect a fucking Jaeger that size coming up, like, undetected.
But because it's a popcorn movie, I forgave that and one other thing that I thought
also,
was,
if a human builds it, who, like, where is this operation?
I thought one thing at the very ending was just totally, completely, and utterly ridiculous, but I loved it, and that's when Eastwood shows up and punches what's his name in the face.
Yeah
I mean, I just, it comes out of nowhere, but I said great.
That was
fun. I'm so satisfied.
No, that was satisfying.
And also, you also know there's another thing I loved, and that's
what
all these Chinese faces.
Oh yeah, so here,
all I recognize.
Look, I really, like, I'm Chinese.
Yes.
In case listeners
again
know.
That's his,
like, I have no problem with a lot of, like, Chinese films, like, you know, pouring tons of money into these films to make themselves more, you know, internationally, like, here. But come on, man. Some of the signs on the fucking door are Chinese and not English? Are you fucking kidding me?
I love it.
I didn't mind this because, like, the product
it's
placement in, like Independence, the new
Chinese.
Independence Day, like, the product placement in that was astoundingly annoying. But, like, this one, like, we were talking, we were like, the only product placement in this was, like, the beer. It was really subtle.
Pizza.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, good. Like,
didn't they do Coca-Cola
down
too?
A little bit.
Yeah,
I'm
but
talking,
like,
about
Chinese.
Chinese stuff.
Yeah, Qingdao
like,
pizza.
In Independence Day Resurgence, like, there's a shot where he's drinking, like, basically,
the
like, a Yakult, like a yogurt
well,
milk.
Nothing will ever beat Iron Man 3 when they have the entire soy milk commercial.
Yeah.
But that's okay. What I love is Tian Jing from The Great Wall, which is a terrible movie, gets to save the world here, as does Max Zhang, who may slightly, possibly be a guest at my Kung Fu Extravaganza this year. Max Zhang,
no,
general.
Like, her character,
so great.
Her character, again, like, in the beginning, I didn't really like her character, but
so
I like
she's the classic cliche.
Yeah, she's the
Chinese.
Yeah.
But that
woman,
was
Chinese.
The great thing about her.
I know.
Yeah, no.
It was, I loved it.
She changed.
Oh, yeah.
She literally let her hair down.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Well, no, awesome. Because in the beginning, like, she's a badass throughout, because in the beginning she's all business, like, this is my life's work, I don't take bullshit from nobody, and if you're working for a Chinese company, you learn fucking Chinese, like, that's plain and simple. I like that. Again, the only thing I didn't like about this whole thing is, again, some of the signs are in Chinese and there's no English under it, and that doesn't fucking make
sense. For me, I will say that the very
when was the last time you were in China?
A while.
When was the last time you were in China?
Well, yeah. What do you mean?
I was in China a couple of years ago, and I saw a lot of signs like that.
Yeah, because it's China.
Yeah, I know. They were in Shanghai. That's where her headquarters is.
Yeah, but they're doing it's an international. Well, yeah, in her headquarters. No, in the
kaiju. Yeah,
in the kaiju.
Because it's mostly Chinese money.
Yeah, bitch.
I understand that it upset you, but at the same time, I understood completely.
I get it. I'm just,
and you're
Chinese.
I don't get it. If it's an international,
we're on either
like,
side of the
I didn't like the part where when the part when the caps like the cockpit opened up and there was just a kaiju brain. That part made me laugh, and that wasn't a part that was supposed to make you laugh.
No, it was supposed to make you laugh.
It didn't.
That's
I don't
the Daleks.
Think so. I didn't like it.
I loved it because that's the Daleks.
For me, it was like that. Like
from Doctor Who.
It took me to a place where I was like, all right, movie. I've given you a lot of passes, but like, give me a fucking break.
No.
And to be honest, that was one of the annoying things that like I'm like, okay, if this
that.
Is the closest thing I'm ever gonna get to like a live action like Evangelion,
yeah.
Like I wanted this movie to. I had really hoped that they would do more with like the people piloting, maybe the Jaegers that were a little bit more like again, like the whole thing with like adding more of the kaiju.
I
into
wanted
them.
That in the first.
I wanted more of the kaiju, like the kaiju power on the human side, and like kind of that. Maybe that be like a secret plot.
And also, there was one moment where they did wushu. There was one moment where the pilots did wushu. Just one moment, and it's just like cut away from
was
it.
Was that shot where they're like the fly kick?
Yeah, they're doing the fly kick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, going, all right.
Like the Indian.
Because I knew this was a dumb movie. But I love the
but
little
but it was
things.
The best dumb movie.
Yeah. No, it's not the best dumb
and again,
movie.
What's the best dumb movie then?
Pacific Rim 1.
Oh my God, that's not a dumb movie.
Yeah,
trick was, question.
Yeah, that's right. But also, like I said, as a Doctor Who fan, I loved when the brain was in there because that is the Dalek
Doctor. I have to say something too.
That's so
like,
great.
You can't fucking set up... You can't have a very iconic character in the first one, Gypsy Danger,
yeah.
coming back as Gypsy Avenger,
yeah.
and they changed it. They have like the two double swords and crap.
Yeah.
The Gypsy Avenger has two freaking like nuclear
thing.
Fusion head in the body. Like,
yep.
What's your point?
Yeah, what is your point?
In the first one, they used that like as a central plot because everything was electrified. It was gone. That's the fusion. That's
yeah,
keeping Gypsy Danger.
Because it's analog.
Yeah, it's analog. But this one, like, they didn't use that, and they showed it in the camera. Like when they pan up to Gypsy Avenger, it was like front and center. It's like, boom, we have that feature. You like that feature? We added a small one at the bottom. Underutilized at all. In the first one, they use it twice.
I love the fact that, you know, he's passionate about the first one, which I don't remember any of this at all.
We recently rewatched it.
Oh, that could have explained.
Yeah.
And I thought for sure there was a live-action Evangelion. I'll look into it. I know there's a bunch of animated.
Oh, so like,
Evangelion.
Yeah, and like I said, they took it too seriously.
Well, no, it's like for me, like when I first saw Pacific
Rim.
Seriously?
Yeah, I did.
When I saw Pacific Rim in theaters for the first time,
I didn't think they took anything seriously.
I was sitting there, and I was just like, he ripped I was kind of sitting there like a little annoyed at Del Toro because I was kind of just like, but now I'll never get an Evangelion movie because
I think
like
you will.
Everyone's going to be like, oh, they ripped that from Pacific Rim.
Well, they ripped it from everything.
Oh, I know.
But that's what I loved about the second one. So we know where we all stand. Jen and I liked it a lot, and I'm loving it all the more because I realized, yeah, that's from this, that's from this, that's from this,
yeah.
that's from this.
Again.
And it's all just a little kind of like, you know, a little nod
to
the audience, a little wink.
Goofy doesn't mean they don't take, like, the character
goofy.
Doesn't take it seriously.
No, the characters took it seriously.
Yeah, that's,
yeah.
I don't like that.
I did.
No, no, oh. I mean, I don't
they
know.
They played
I, like, I don't think you know what you're saying.
No, I don't know how
no,
to explain
he knows what he's
it,
saying.
Like, right, but the whole story and the whole feel of it is so serious,
yes.
and all the character and the dialogues are so goofy that
but
it's
the point
not
here
good.
Is, yeah, you didn't like it.
Yes.
We liked it.
Yes.
And it's for the same reason. It's for the same reason.
Yeah.
Is it so?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Like,
we took it differently.
We
reacted to it differently.
We like corniness, and you were...
I do like corniness.
I like winkiness.
Not this time.
But you didn't... Not this one, because it's obvious that you're passionate about the first one.
Oh, yeah, because, again, the first one...
Why call it Pacific Rim, right? But that's
yeah.
what they're going to call it, because that's what's marketable. And that's how they could get it sold.
Yeah. No, I get it.
But that's why, in my description of it, I called it...
Mighty Morphin.
No, Pacific Power Rangers Transformers Rising. Because I understood. Now I'm putting Doctor Who in it, too. But anyway, so, yeah, so we differ. Now, should we even talk about Sherlock Gnomes and Isle of Dogs?
If you want to talk about Sherlock Gnomes, it's up to
Sherlock
here.
Gnomes.
We didn't see it.
Yeah.
No, but we just saw Isle of Dogs, and it's so awesome. And it makes a good comparison, yin-yang, to wrap it up with. Because Sherlock Gnomes, it cost $30 million. Isle of Dogs, $25 million. My buddy John Stevenson, the co-director of Kung Fu Panda, it's his first movie after Kung Fu Panda. This
Solo?
Is like...
Wow, it's
yeah,
been a while.
It's been a long time. I'm happy to hear that he's supposedly directing The Aardvark and The Ark, which is another upcoming animated movie, which I'm happy for him. The best thing about Sherlock Gnomes, and I love Sherlock Holmes, is what John Stevenson was able to do, all the in-jokes, because it's not a very entertaining movie.
Oh.
A five-year-old I know really, really loved it. And I wish... And you know, I'm basically five-year-old.
That's usually enough.
Yeah. I'm a five-year-old, but there's not enough five-year-olds going to it. And what the best animated movies do is they speak to the five-year-old and everybody.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And this one didn't speak to the five-year-old and me. This one was...
I still haven't seen the first Sherlock Holmes.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Which is not that great either.
I've seen it, but
I still would like to see it.
I can't remember anything from it.
That's the thing. And Sherlock Gnomes has a very powerful character in Sherlock Holmes and Watson, and they use it, and the little extras and the in-jokes and the Easter eggs that John puts in, he brings in James Hong. He has a whole scene in Chinatown in London. And he's just it's like he's saying, Rick, hello, look what I'm doing, because he's putting in all these massive amounts of, because he said there was more allusions to the movie called Touch of Zen in Kung Fu Panda than any other movie. And but you have to know Touch of Zen to get any of
that. That's a fun video essay we got to jump on.
Oh baby, what, Touch of Zen. Have you seen it?
Yeah,
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's very interpretable.
I told you I had a Asian cinema in a global context class in college, and we covered Bollywood anime and wuxia.
Yeah,
so that's when I saw like 36 Chambers and like a whole bunch of those.
Touch of Zen is great because the first 90 minutes is a Hong Kong movie, and they say you may have to make it longer, so the last hour he goes, King Hu goes, go away, ignore me. It's like it's an existential art film attached to a classic Chinese film. It's very clever and fun and interpretable. But be that as it may, Sherlock Gnomes has some wonderful in-jokes. At one point, there's a label that says Harryhausen on it.
Beautiful.
And all sorts of other things like that. And he also puts in non-computer animated stuff. He uses the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock and his mind room, and he uses it as a cartoon. He puts it in as a black and white cartoon throughout the film.
Okay. Oh, that's cute.
There's some very cute things in it, but not enough. Mm-hmm. Not nearly enough. And it's all over the place and it has no
real effect.
What's
the story about?
The story is actually somewhat cunning in that there's a Moriarty character who is a cross between the baby from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Boss Baby. Basically, he's a you know, what's that hamburger mascot in L.A. Big Boy?
Yeah, Big Boy.
It's a character like that, except he sells pies, and he's Moriarty.
I really thought you were going to say pot, and I was going to be really confused.
That would have been awesome. Pies, and
all right,
he's a villain, and his job is to destroy all the gnomes in London.
Is he a gnome?
He's an anti-gnome.
Wait, what is he?
Is he secretly a gnome?
He's just
a toy.
He's a plaster mascot.
Oh, okay.
They're all plaster.
Toy Story, but gnomes versus.
But gnomes, but name, and also they have stones. They have.
It's basically what that is.
They have gargoyles. They have gargoyles in it. Stone gargoyles.
Yeah, so it's like again, Toy Story.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah.
And Sherlock is dedicated to save all the gnomes of London. That's his only.
Is it a mystery?
Yes.
At all? Okay, it is.
A mystery that you can solve along with the characters?
Yes, I was way ahead of it.
Okay.
Which was.
All right, Ryan.
It all turned out. It all. You know. Again, spoiler alert. It all turned out to be Watson. Didn't all turn out. It turned out to be Watson trying, because he's treating Watson like crap throughout the whole movie. And it turns out, and he said, the only way I get you to notice me was to become
one of
Moriarty. And then it turns out Moriarty was plotting around him and manipulated Watson into doing
double cross.
Double, triple cross. But it wasn't nearly as clever as it should have been. It wasn't nearly. I mean, it's one thing to entertain the 5-year-olds.
Who wrote it?
I'll tell you, as a matter of fact. Ben Zazov. He has one previous credit, which was a 2012 Tooth Fairy 2 video.
What the fuck?
The Tooth Fairy 2.
Man, why do I think
direct to video? Well, you have to be in the right place. Meanwhile, the stories, give it time, the story was written by Andy Reilly, who worked on Veep, Kevin Cecil, who worked on the Tracy Ullman show and Veep, Emily Cook and Kathy Greenberg, who worked on the who worked on Romeo and Juliet.
That was a good comedy writer.
And also you have to suck up to Elton John.
I thought it was one writer and then he kept going and then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and well, no, the it was one writer who did the screenplay.
Oh, but it was the story.
The story was done by these other people.
Right, right.
But you have to suck up to Elton John because Elton John was the producer of the film. It's from his Rocket Films.
Yeah.
And also it has all his music in it, which is always welcome.
Was it like a jukebox musical or was it like a
original? It should have been. That was one of the other things that
was
disappointed
in. Was Romeo and Juliet a jukebox musical or was it
was
all
more
original?
Of a jukebox musical than this one was. This one they repeated a lot of stuff and it would have been, and I always love it when the bitch's back is suddenly appears, but he doesn't sing it. You just
hear
the music.
They reference back to the two Romans.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Yeah,
okay,
that's the main kid. It's the main
I know, couple. I know, but like in the story do they reference back because it doesn't make sense for them to reference back because it's
but it's really
gone
it's really
so long
and they also have a minion like because the gnomes are like the minions and all the other gnomes are like the minions and they reference and they have an intro to the movie where they're in a library and the three main gnomy minions are going our new story and they all start and that's a pretty cute moment they all start saying well why don't we do this and they're making all these gnome puns of other great titles and other great ideas.
Funny.
So it's entertaining enough.
I can appreciate that because I feel like again that was a conversation we had recently where like for me I was kind of thinking about sometimes sequels, it's like you're almost like if a studio knows that they're gonna make a sequel and they're sitting there and they're like, okay, well, like what can we do in this universe? And you're kind of like bound by like the characters and the pre-existing stuff. Where it's like it's fun like if you have just like a world and you can't just tell a completely different story in that same world.
And that's what they should have done. I liked one critic's.
Yeah, I was under the impression like when I first announced it, I was like, oh, they're just gonna go with the whole gnome thing, and that was the only connection.
No, well, it was kind of.
Yeah. Mm.
But at the same time, I liked what one critic said, which was, we deserve better.
Mm.
When you have Sherlock Holmes, you have Romeo and Juliet, you have Elton John, and also their voice cast
was
like jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good?
Johnny
Depp was
Sherlock Gnomes.
Or Gnomes, all right, whatever.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp?
Yeah, Johnny Depp.
So
and
bad.
Also,
no, it
no,
was like
great.
They got like such a big,
got,
I mean, I feel like what
everybody.
Has he done recently that's really impressive? But, like,
but even
but,
so,
like,
getting
like,
him,
fine.
Getting him, they have Stephen Merchant, they have Michael Caine.
Emily Blunt was the gnome in the...
And
Steve McAvoy.
Yeah. James McAvoy.
Yeah, that guy.
Was Romeo. They had everybody, every single voice.
Yes, a third of their budget goes towards the story.
That kills me.
I think it was all favors for Elton John.
Probably, actually.
Oh,
Elton John.
I was like, the budget was so small. Like, because it was only 30 million.
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
no,
normally
that's
like the entire budget for an actor.
Yeah. So
now they don't take as much when they do voice acting.
It is worth.
I know.
It is not worth paying money for.
Yeah.
It's not worth going into the movie theaters and wasting it on a big screen because it certainly doesn't require a big screen.
Unless you have a movie pass, then go ahead.
You have a movie pass or wait for it to come on video or whatever. I suggest you guys watch it again. But I wanted more for my buddy John. I wanted him to do something as good, if not better, than Kung Fu Panda. And
Kung Fu Panda 1, right?
Yeah, he did Kung Fu Panda 1.
He co-directed with Mark Osborne.
Yeah, that's so long ago.
I know.
I hope he keeps directing.
He kept on. The last time he said, okay, we're all set. I'm directing the live-action Masters of the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it went... disappeared.
So he just had a string of bad luck, basically.
Well, not bad. Like, just he didn't want to choose anything.
Oh, okay.
He didn't want, and it's the same thing with Mark.
Like projects just fall through.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. A string of
bad
luck.
But a lot of
you,
them.
Like you choose a project you really passionate about, and then they happen to.
And
fall apart.
Mark Osborne makes Little Prince.
Which is pretty
awesome.
Yeah.
And that's a good segue to the last movie we saw, and the best, certainly, probably better than all these other movies put together.
Yeah.
Yes.
Isle of Dogs.
Absolutely.
Isle of Dogs. I've created, I love words like extraordinary. Extraordinary is actually extraordinary. And also, there are other words like that, like remarkable. Remarkable is that you can remark about it. If you remark about it, that means it's remarkable. But this movie is extraordinary. Isle of Dogs is one of the great individual works of labor of love art I've ever seen. It is a movie where, you know, Miko was asking during the end credits, who produced this? And I'm going, they produced it, because no one else would.
No, I mean, I didn't say who produced it. I said who animated it.
Who animated
it? I wanted,
like, you wanted it to be a studio.
Yeah, I want to know this, either the studio or, like, the agency that they have for that. Cause
I'll put it on the supplementals if I can find it.
I mean, again, the animation is really well done.
Yeah.
It's very subtle. It's quirky.
It's labor of love crazy.
Yeah, there's so many times where they have a far shot of the dog on the pile. All I want is just all I can imagine in my head is just the dog going, raise his hand like,
oh,
fantastic,
yes.
Mr. Fox. All I can see
the
is
wolf
that.
At the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every shot is thought out.
Although
every shot is beautifully
for you.
Done.
For me,
I have not seen Fantastic Mr. Fox in a long time.
Yeah.
I don't remember if, because I know Wes Anderson liked to do a lot of quirky camera moves and pans and whatnot, like straight pans and like and dolly in and all that stuff. So, did he do that in Fantastic Mr. Fox as well?
Yeah.
Was it as jarring as this?
No.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. Because that's why this movie is so extraordinary. I liked Fantastic Mr. Fox.
This movie did camera moves and stuff where I was just like, how the fuck did the animator time that?
No. Now there's more sophisticated mechanics. You can time it, but I was going to say because
they
still have
to match their animation to the camera move, even if they automate the camera.
Course, because there's no motion blur on films, we shot every single footage, every frame, it depends on how it is. But like, it's a bit jarring sometimes with the camera move.
Oh,
in terms of visual.
Like I said.
Me.
Well, yeah, it was jarring, but in a good way.
Yeah, I was saying, like, what? Like, when there was a scene where they kind of did like a That 70s Show, like, pot round table thing where they kind
of would quickly.
Was it like that?
No. It was a lot of the pans. A lot of pans and dolly in.
Oh, I like
when
they
like slowly dolly in, it was fine. And there's like there's one point where
it's like a
big zoom bat.
Oh, no.
With zoom, not zoom out, dolly out.
Yeah.
Or pan. Those are, again, like, I like the camera, I like the intention,
is
the execution, because there's no motion blur, it feels very stropey.
Oh, I
this
did
movie
not feel that at all.
That's
is
it.
The very definition of idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm.
I will put the definition of idiosyncratic on the supplemental. This movie's the very definition of the difference between Fantastic Mr. Fox and this one.
Mm-hmm.
Is Fantastic Mr. Fox was done for a studio, was done for an animation house, so they had to toe the lines of what the studio and the executives needed. Mm-hmm. They made an entertainment, which was a good entertainment, a very good entertainment, and I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I love Isle of Dogs, because Isle of Dogs was F you.
Yeah.
I'm going to do exactly what I want.
It's like the most successful PG-13 animated film of all time.
And I don't care what you want.
Yeah.
I don't care what you, the studio, wants. I don't care what you, the distributor, wants. I don't care what you, the audience, wants.
But it's still very Wes, like...
But that's the
that's
point.
That's why he
it's
can do
that.
It's
pure Wes Anderson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pure.
But he didn't answer to anyone.
Yeah.
He did what he wanted to do.
Oh, yeah. No, it was...
That's why I love the idea that in the last shot, I'm sure there are so many allusions to other things, especially Japanese cinema.
Oh, yeah, it was like Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah, the last shot when there's a character that feeds the dogs in essentially the last shot. I'm pretty sure that's the character from Akira Kurosawa's Ron.
Mm-hmm.
He looks at the audience, but it was too fast. I'm going, what? I have to see it, but I'm going to get.
Because he was the guy from the beginning of the film, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of allusions and illusions to this, but that's what makes this movie so special in that. It is answerable to no one but the maker.
Mm-hmm.
This is why Wes Anderson essentially signed the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film by Wes Anderson. And no one, even though a lot of other people worked on it.
I really like the humor.
There was some criticism after Fantastic Mr. Fox in that Wes Anderson really didn't direct it. It was the head of animation.
Oh, well, yeah.
Really
I heard that there were a lot of issues where he couldn't spend a lot of time on set.
Same thing with this one?
No.
No.
That's the point.
Honestly,
he was on set.
The only negative thing.
He was
thing,
every single frame you could see him in it.
I've avoided, like, obviously, I didn't want to read reviews or anything, but the one thing that I saw a couple of titles of articles. And the only negative thing that I saw people say about this film was people were kind of feeling that, like, Like, it seemed like there were some people, and I feel like you're going to get this no matter what. People were like, oh, like, the representation of Japanese people.
Oh,
blah,
that's
blah,
right.
Blah.
Oh, there
and
was
it was one of those things where, like, obviously, I'm not
tempest.
Japanese. I'm not Asian at all.
Yeah.
Like, I can't speak for that experience.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I know I sound, like, for me, it was kind of like, oh, like, I didn't feel like I'm usually overly sensitive to that sort of thing where
right.
I'd be like, oh, like, I'm, like, I think that might have kind of been offensive or, like, you know, whatever, to yeah. the point where, like, one of my Chinese coworkers, she'll, like, the other day, like, I, like, there was something where I was like, oh, like, that looks, like, really racist, and she was just like, oh my god, stop, like, you have such white guilt right now.
Well, that's
and I was
it.
Just like, no, and then, like, in this, like, I was like, I really didn't feel that way,
no,
but I don't mean
there
to
were
say
people
that.
Who did.
Yeah, and I could totally understand
they
that.
Would say, yeah.
The only thing in there that feels a little bit like that, but not specifically to Japanese culture, that I felt was the hacker kid.
Yeah.
He's like a very typical, like,
yeah.
Asian hacker.
But he's an awesome kid.
Yeah.
He's
no, no.
Awesome
his character
yeah,
was
I
awesome.
Loved
yeah.
but I loved his, like,
but
the
his caricature.
Yeah.
You know, his caricature
yeah.
was
yeah.
that stereotype.
Yeah, and I
yeah.
understand
sure.
that there's
yeah.
some people said that, yeah. you know, you were appropriating Japanese culture.
Yeah, like, people were like, did this have to take place in Japan?
And that's what made me think,
have to be
well,
whatever.
That's the point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what he said was what the Kung Fu Panda people said.
Mm-hmm.
It's a China of our own devising.
Yeah.
It's
yeah, a country
it's a
that
fantastic,
has...
It's a fantastic
it takes place
world.
Yeah.
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 Like, yeah, for
it's
me,
not
like,
Japan,
yeah.
Japan.
No.
It's like a
it's
fantastic
always this kind of weird thing where it's like if somebody makes a film about a country or, you know, or mm-hmm. influenced by a country that's not their own, like, there always is that... That like
yeah you can't
yeah,
do
like,
that
yeah they're you're not going to get it totally right. Mulan, you know, all of the Disney films that take place in other countries, you know, that's just these people's interpretation.
And I'm
of
sure
it.
Anybody
yeah.
who
unless
wants
you do Wakanda.
But now, you know, at this point, everybody has to.
I have no comment.
Everybody, not everybody, but there will always be people in this Facebook.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In this spleen book
oh, yeah,
generation
for sure.
who will say, oh, you had to put a white girl in it, didn't you? You know, there'll always be shit like
yeah,
that.
Of course.
But that shit, when you look at the artistry and the gloriousness and the idiosyncrasy and the specialness and the unique, I can say this is a uniqueness of this movie. It is a. I love movies. I love movies like Memento, which could only be a movie. It uses movies, and this uses not so much Japan, but Japanese movies
mm-hmm.
and Japanese culture. And Japan and it's who was the other guy who let the culture seep in? Oh yeah, the guy who did Annihilation. Mm. He didn't actually adapt the book.
Yeah.
He adapted his vision of the book, which he didn't even finish the book. So it's kind of like, yeah, this is just such a special piece of work. And I said at the end of it, I want all, you know, me, the fight scene guy,
mm-hmm.
I want all fights to be done the way they're done in Isle of Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Isle of Dogs
a cloud of cotton.
That was like Fantastic Mr. Fox had that too.
Yeah, a cloud of cotton, which is basically the same thing they do in Popeye, and I don't know if I told you guys this. I told Bill Frakey this earlier, and I'm telling everybody. Turner Classic Movies has, even though you guys, I don't think, get that. You don't have the video. On Saturday mornings, they're doing the entire matinee experience now. They're showing a chapter from a serial, a cartoon, and for the last couple of weeks, it's been Tarzan movies. But what they've done, because they started the last 3 weeks, they did the first chapter of Red Barry, which is a very rare sequence. Then they're showing in order of their production and release the Popeye cartoon.
Oh.
How exciting.
It was,
that's the one thing I miss about, not the one thing.
There was one I had never seen.
TCM.
Last week when they showed Tarzan the Ape Man, Tarzan and his mate, Tarzan Escapes, which is arguably the three best Tarzan ever done. And Tarzan and his mate is probably
one of the
best.
My dad's probably been watching.
Yeah. But then last week.
You said there's Saturday morning, sorry.
Popeye the Sailor Man, when Popeye.
What time on Saturdays?
It starts at 10.
Okay.
So the Popeye cartoon started about 10:15. Blow Me Down was last week, which is astonishing Popeye cartoon, because that's when Popeye was still a bit of Thimble Theater, which was the original comic strip that mm-hmm. Popeye appeared in.
You said there's one you've never seen before.
That was Blow Me Down.
Yeah.
Blow Me Down has Olive Oil working as a songstress and basically a stripper in a dive bar at
all
the
right,
wharf.
All right, girl. You get your money.
That's right. It was... because like I said, they were segueing from the Thimble Theater, the original comic strip Popeye, into the Popeye of cartoons who eventually was created. So watching these first, and also the violence is so spectacularly wonderful.
Like early Mickey Mouse when he was like a total dick, and and everybody, I loved him.
They were elevating the fight in Blow Me Down with Bluto, between Pluto and Popeye, and the way Popeye won was the same way that the whatchamacallit one in Pacific Rim. What are the robots called?
The Jaegers.
The way the Jaeger won at the end. At the end of Pacific Rim Uprising was the way Popeye won.
He like launched himself in the air.
No, he didn't launch himself. Bluto launched him with a punch.
Oh.
It was they were exchanging punches that were getting
around.
More and more extreme. And the last punch by Bluto was so hard it sent Popeye into orbit. And when he re-entered back. And it was like, and I'm holding onto my head.
I was like, make that into a supercut. Like.
Yeah, just awesome. So by the time you hear this, which will be hopefully this Saturday, unfortunately about an hour after the move, this week's movies ends, but at least I wanted to let you guys know, and hopefully they'll repeat it at some point. I'm gonna get in touch with everybody joined backstage the TCM fan club and demand they reshow the first the Popeye cartoons in order. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think we're done, right?
Yeah, like holy shit, Isle of Dogs.
Yeah,
there better be an art book because
fantastic movie.
Goddamn
really
it, fantastic, Mr.
Awesome animation again. Like
awesome
the eye motions, very subtle. Everything.
Acting, the voice acting, everything
voice
is
acting.
So great. And also you've got to get the DVD or the Blu-ray to get the extras, because already you can go on the web and see the making of.
Yeah,
and they also do interviews with all the dogs.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That are completely separate from the movie. Just the dogs talking, and again.
Oh, yeah.
Talk
yeah.
about a voice cast.
I didn't see that because I didn't want to see anything before
I didn't
the movie.
Either.
So now I'm going back.
It's just so it's just
I'm
extraordinary.
Hoping, so all of Wes Anderson's films are on the Criterion Collection, and I'm really hoping that they'll
I have Fantastic Mr.
Fox, and it's this beautiful like kind of little like box set.
Yeah.
And I really hope they do that for this.
Also, a little extra, they actually show operation happening with the kidney transplant.
Oh yeah,
fantastic! Because that, like kids will be like, oh, what is that? And then parents can actually go like, hey, this is what happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile,
it's a great educational.
Meanwhile, Leica, I believe, has what is Leica?
What a dork!
Did Leica cut its entire staff? I mean, they had a huge amount layoff at Leica. The guys who made Kubo,
Leica?
Yeah,
Kubo and
like
the Two Strings.
One of the animators I know, like
a couple weeks ago.
Freelance. Yeah,
I have no idea.
Yeah, and now but you compare Kubo and the Two Strings to this Isle of Dogs, and you see why.
Yeah.
Kubo and the Two Strings was just killing time, while
that's
Isle of Dogs
was
just
problem,
like
not the animation's problem. Animation.
Well, I don't care. Yeah, again,
I'm like, he's not without, saying that.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I'm not saying the animation. Matter of fact, the best thing about Kubo and the Two Strings was behind the scenes.
Animation, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Better you should see the making of it than to see the actual film.
Yeah.
But the thing about Isle of Dogs, no, they're both awesome.
Fascinating.
They're both awesome and amazing and wonderful. And that speaks to the 5-year-old in me.
The only thing I didn't like was the smoke.
Oh, I love the smoke!
No.
Yeah.
The only thing I didn't like about the smoke was the beginning when the plane dropped down and then the ball of getting bigger. Because you've seen the dog, but it feels physically coming towards you.
Yeah.
Because it's getting bigger. And,
but I thought that was purposeful.
Yeah, I thought it was cool.
I thought it was purposeful.
I didn't mind.
It didn't bother me.
Because the plane crash was shot. The plane crash was shot in a really flat profile.
I understand.
I understand. That's the only one that's kind of jarring to me to see that getting bigger.
Yeah.
All the other perspective wise, it was.
I understand why you feel that way. But Pacific Rim Uprising, buddy.
For me, I really liked this because it was really refreshing to see a movie about with animal. I'm talking. It was fun. Oh my God! Let's all talk.
Let's all talk at the same time.
The part that I really liked, one of the things I really liked about this was because, I've seen a lot of Disney movies and different stuff where there's different animal, there's animal characters, but. This movie was so good about, it was a film starring dogs, but it was they were actually dogs. I don't know how to explain how I feel.
I know how you, that's perfect. That's a perfect way, because that's what Isle of Dogs is. It's almost impossible to describe.
Yeah.
How it makes you feel.
They weren't just they just weren't dogs with human personalities ascribed to them. All the jokes, all the stuff.
They were unique.
They were just
cinematic characters.
Yeah, they were just real dogs.
But at the same time, they weren't.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. All right, listen. Listen to me, you two. Listen carefully.
Time for
IHOP.
Yes.
Yeah, well, more than that. It's time for Use Your Blinkers Jackass.
And Rick, chew your goddamn food at IHOP.
Yeah.
Okay, break it up. Break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com where the excitement never ends.
Solving the dream.